3, 2, 1.
Truthfully, I fell in love with an industry that excluded me, as you said, and wasn't built to involve me as a creator, but also wasn't built to reflect me as a consumer or as a lover of fashion. And it didn't dissuade me. And even though it wasn't necessarily a motivator for me when I first kind of found my way into fashion to change things, I found that my existence in the industry is radical in and of itself. At the end of, you know, a couple of internships, I was still like fascinated and obsessed with Vogue. And I think that like part of this is actually this like internalized idea that mediocrity can't exist for me.
Oh man, today's guest, Gabriella Carifa Johnson. She's a fashion stylist we all need in our lives. In December 2020, Gabriella became the first Black woman to style a Vogue cover, and her light has shone long before that. She is the fashion director of Garage Magazine, curating and styling spreads that always cause some noise. She tells stories through her styling and focuses on diversifying representation in a high fashion landscape. I met Gabriella at a Prada dinner in Milan. She greeted me like we were old friends, and we immediately started dishing stories. Luckily for you all, she does that here too. We talk about breaking into an industry as a person who doesn't meet the typical cookie cutter standard of fashion, navigating what it means to finally get hired for jobs when it seems more, quote, trendy to hire BIPOC. And of course, Gabriella's fashion story, fashion inspirations, and fashion aspirations. Come join Gabriella and I for this guided storytelling session. Hello, hello, hello.
Hello.
I'm so happy to see you dressed colorfully and just bringing in the spring.
That's what I'm trying to do. I'm from California, LA girl. I've never in my 11 years of New York gone used to winter, so I'm always trying to bring the summer in somehow.
Wait, so what is considered cold to you these days?
Okay, so I think if you're going under 50 degrees, that's a proper chill. That's a proper
classic
cold.
California. 50 degrees to me is like summertime now.
Oh, Lord. Well, yeah. I mean, you're basically in like a glacial. Camp Boss is in a snowy glacial paradise that I would like to visit, but like in the summer.
Oh, totally. So do you go by Gabriella all the time, or do some people call you Gabby?
Some people call me Gabby. Some people call me Gab. Some people call me G. I tried to do that. I had one of those very, very
GJK.
Long names. Yeah, exactly. GKJ. But I had this very long name growing up, and it always got shrunken into something else. And I figure my favorite of them is Gabby. But Gab is also fine.
Oh, I love that. What is your relationship with your name? Because I had what was an interesting name to other people growing up. I always felt like I had to explain my name.
Yeah.
Or people would just call me Nora and I would be too shy to say something.
1,000%. I think I definitely went through that phase of just being like, oh, I just want to make it easier for everyone else. How do I make myself smaller, my name more pronounceable? And the thing is, it's an Italian name, Gabriella, and then I have a West African and Trinidadian last name, hyphenated Carifa Johnson. And for some reason, that hyphenated last name just has not been cracked by the masses. I don't know what it is, whether it's Starbucks, like the airport. It's just, I'm either going to be Carifa or Johnson. So I've become very aware of that, but I've been a little bit firmer in trying to make sure that people pronounce my name correctly, because it's just not that hard.
And also because it's your name. I'm like such a big believer in protecting our names, because
yeah.
I think especially if you're first gen or an immigrant, so many people feel like they have to do an American name so that it's easier for other people. That's part of our beauty, and like that's what you bring here is embracing something different. How is your heart doing these days?
How is my heart doing? You know, I had a very tough time coming back to New York. I, like many people, went to California to be with my mom and my family at the kind of top of the pandemic. And it was such an environment of love and safety and comfort. And I kind of like, regressed back into my childhood form of Gabby, and it was really, really safe and really, really comfortable. And then I, as all of us started to process that we need to figure out a way to work and to live in this kind of new landscape. And I came back to New York, and it's felt very isolating and almost like work has taken over a lot of the parts of my life that I would, fulfill myself and satisfy myself in other ways. So it's been go, go, go. I think I've really been busier in this pandemic than I was beforehand, which seems very, very crazy. And it takes a toll on, the mental and the heart and just it's been difficult to to navigate, but I do feel extremely lucky to be, employed. I'll say that.
Did you expect to be as busy as you have been this last year? I feel like this has been the Gabby year. I mean, I've seen you everywhere. I've gotten joy from the art that you are creating. It feels so needed right now.
I am so happy to hear that. And it's also incredibly flattering. And I still can't really get over the fact that so many of the goals that I set for myself as a kid going out into this industry, I've been able to meet in this year of all years. But yeah, it's been certainly the busiest I've ever been. It was kind of like my career was hitting the stride that I've always wanted it to hit right at the time that the rest of the world was unraveling. And I think it was comforting to me as a workaholic and also somebody who feels that there is urgency in the message that I'm creating with my work in the fashion industry. I felt that pouring myself into my work was the best way to adapt to like a very, very bizarre moment. And I'm not sure if that was the right idea, but it has paid off in the traditional sense.
This has also been a year of survival. And so I've just been celebrating anybody who's been able to make a living, keep a living, figure out how to pivot. It's just such a win, regardless, especially if you're creating art that you really believe in. You mentioned the importance of your message. What is your message right now?
Well, I think what the message has always been is that fashion is big enough for all of us. It should include and reflect all of us. And that message is in a little bit of discord with the idea of luxury. And so I've always tried to operate in the high fashion space, which has been historically rarefied and not available or accessible to most, and find ways of incorporating the audiences and the stories that have been excluded for so long. So that's, I guess, the overarching goal. But the message has so as much to do with that as it has to do with self-love. I feel like I've come into a place where I adore myself. I love my body. I've like worked really hard to not only be comfortable with who I am and what I look like in this world and in this body, but really adore that. So I've often found that a way of providing that to people who might look like me, who are 13 years old and didn't have a fashion editorial that had a curve model or a plus size woman, is to just make those images. It's the only way to kind of fix the problem is to make it happen.
How did you make the decision to enter a space where you didn't see yourself represented? What was it about fashion that was so enamoring to you?
That's a good question. And it's hard because truthfully, I fell in love with an industry that excluded me, as you said, and wasn't built to involve me as a creator, but also wasn't built to reflect me as a consumer or as a lover of fashion. And it didn't dissuade me. And even though it wasn't necessarily a motivator for me when I first kind of found my way into fashion to change things, I found that my existence in the industry is radical in and of itself. And the way that I guess what I first was drawn to in fashion was the idea of possibility and like the idea of fantasy and the escapism of it all. I grew up in like small suburban Southern California towns, and I just there was nothing more glamorous and exciting in the world of fashion to me. And it's something that I probably should have never even known about. Like there wasn't an interest in fashion in the communities that I was growing within. It was more that my family had this like innate sense of style, and I just saw personal style as an expression of fashion. And then I found that there was an industrial level of exploring style and fashion, and I figured that should be what I do for my job. But it's an interesting story because my aunt, who is literally the most glamorous woman in the world to me, and she's my mother's older sister, she was kind of like the black sheep of the family. It's like a family of like educators and doctors and lawyers, and she was like, I'm gonna be a model in Paris in the 70s, and like ran away. And I just remember being in her house in Connecticut growing up and looking through all of her contact sheets and all of the images she took during that time, and seeing her on the runways, and really acutely understanding that very few people looked like her. And it was like the idea of standing out and kind of being the only one that was super seductive to me. And I thought, well, she did it and she was amazing and it was so fun. I guess I'm gonna do it. But I think it was pretty naive of me at the time because I had no idea just how few people like me were in the industry behind the scenes. I kind of thought you could be a model or you could be buying magazines, and those were the two options.
I guess I never even thought about the concept of a stylist. My love of fashion started from a really young age too, and I just always assumed it was the designer. You just wore the designer, and then people themselves figured out what they were going to wear. I didn't realize that there was such an art and technique to it. But this aunt of yours, just how fabulous. Can you describe her look and her style? I would love to know.
Yes. Okay. So she is like, I want to say she's like 5'10", very Amazon-like. She has these like gorgeous, like strong thighs and like these broad shoulders. And she kind of grew up in this era where the qualities of like black womanhood were definitely fetishized and were like exoticized, and like designers really wanted that look. And she, the way that she was captured never felt tokenistic to me. Like she's so in possession of her body and her beauty, and so in control. And it's something that is not easy to achieve as a model, but she's basically like a glamazon. That's the only way that I can describe her. And she had this very short hair, not unlike mine, like short natural hair, and these like beautiful almond eyes. And we have this weird thing in our family. It's like a genetic thing where we have this gray circle around our irises, and hers are like very pronounced. Mine are like just starting. You can't even see them, but hers are very pronounced. So she has this like otherworldly, like nondescript eye color. She's just really, oh, I love her.
Fabulous.
Fabulous. She's fabulous. Auntie Rosalie, that one's for you.
What an icon. I can already hear it and feel it. It's so comforting to know that you're surrounded by people who were role models to what you wanted to pursue and made it feel possible. But then you come into the industry and into the space, and the comfort isn't the same as at home. How was it for you to first navigate when you entered fashion officially, and what did that look like?
I first started working in fashion because I didn't discover what a stylist was until like well into my career as an intern, or figuring out the mechanisms of magazines and the production of an image. But I became aware of a little bit of what a fashion department does from watching the reality show The Hills. And I was like, and Lauren Conrad was interning for Teen Vogue, and I was an LA girl too. And I was like, you know what? I want to work at Teen Vogue. That's what I want to do. And it was the very beginning of the internet when you could, no, it wasn't the beginning of the internet, but it was the very beginning of like search culture, where like you could find any detail you wanted if you tried hard enough. And I would just open up my Teen Vogue's, and I would spend, they were $3.99 at the time, if you can believe that. Like, that's how cheap magazines were. But I would go through the masthead, and then I would just Google the names of the people on the masthead until I could find, and I would do like first name dot last name, first name underscore last name, until I could find an email address. And eventually I found an email address at Teen Vogue, and I emailed them, and I was like, I'm gonna be going to school in New York. I really want to intern in the fashion industry. I don't know anything about it, but I'm a really hard worker. And they were like, we don't really have any positions, and like, this isn't how this works. And it was very much like a gatekeeper scenario where you know, if you don't have the in, you're not given a chance. But they were like, let me just pass you along to Laura Magazine. Maybe they have something. And I ended up getting a job, getting an interview and getting the job. But I think it was very much, it was similar to a lot of situations I've had in my life where the underestimation is like astounding. It's just this like idea of like, you're not, this just isn't really for you because you don't really like look like what I think like a fashion intern should look like. And you don't really know anyone in New York or in the city and your parents aren't really friends with anyone who works here. So like, I just don't really see this working for you. And it was, and I kind of like begged for an interview and I ended up getting an interview and they asked me who my favorite stylist was. And I think it was supposed to be like a trick question. Like I wouldn't know. And I was like, oh, well, Grace Coddington. And they were really shocked because she was, you know, old school and like very much in the establishment. And it was weird for like a kid from Southern California who's never worked in fashion to know who she was, but I really did my research. And I think part of that in my journey is like a recurring theme of like really trying to prove that I belong. And which is like kind of sad, but it's also really realistic. And I think it's a shared experience for a lot of people in a lot of different industries. Mm-hmm. But it was just like, I wasn't going to take no for an answer. And I was going to prove that I belong to be there. And not only that I belong to be there, but I was going to be the best damn intern you've ever had.
100%. I felt the exact same way in my first internship at CBS Radio. My goal was, I'm going to make sure that they give me a job after this, and I'm going to make sure everyone in this building knows my name. Mm-hmm. And right or wrong, I know that if it wasn't going to be so hard for me to fit in or create the space for myself, I don't know if I would have tried as hard. So I'm so grateful for that, for that challenge.
Totally. It's like it's a survival instinct that you almost like resent that you have, but actually ultimately is the greatest tool in our arsenal. Is like
100%.
I'm not going to allow myself give to be it extinguished. Up. Never.
You said that your favorite stylist was Grace Coddington. You ended up doing work for Grace Coddington. Can you tell me about what that was like?
Yeah. So at the end of, you know, a couple of internships, I was still like fascinated and obsessed with Vogue. And I think that like part of this is actually this like internalized, ingrained idea that like mediocrity can't exist for me. Like I can't be in the middle. Like I have to be at the very, very top. And my value system at the time was telling me that whatever the world has co-signed as the very top of the industry is what should be my top of the industry. That should be my pinnacle. And that should be where I wanted to go. And I was like, not willing to do that. Like 12 years, work your way up from the mailroom to the CEO thing. I was like, no, I'm going to make it there before I graduate college. Like that's just what's going to happen. And then they're going to give me a job. It's exactly like you were talking about with your first internship experience. But I ended up working really hard within the Condé Nast building and then being recommended for this Vogue fashion closet intern. And that was like the creme de la creme of fashion internships. And I ended up getting it. And it was really more of like a support role, like go to Prada and like pick up the boxes and bring them back to the office. I know like every address by heart of every PR company because I was like on the subway holding boxes trying to get there. Like pre-iPhones, I think I had like a Motorola or something. And I like, and I had to like figure out where to go everywhere. Anyway.
Well, we met at a Prada dinner post this show. So I feel like what a turn of events.
It's a full circle thing. I know we love Prada, but it was very much like, I felt so lucky to be in the room. Like I just felt so lucky to be walking through the doors and eventually I had to deliver something to Grace. And I kind of got to know the kind of head of the interns at the time. His name was Bo Sam, who you might know, actually. I don't know. But he was like, well, if you want to move from like the returns closet into the fashion editorial department, like we might have like an opening. And I know you work really hard. And he really noticed that. And I ended up going on shoots with Grace when she needed an extra set of hands. And I ended up meeting Tawny, who later on, a few years later, would become one of my biggest mentors and friends and best bosses I've ever had. And she was the fashion director of Vogue at the time. But working with Grace was like, it was so surreal to me because at this point, like these were my celebrities. It was like, right. I wasn't, I couldn't believe that I would like walk through the door and Anna would walk past, or like Grace and Phyllis and Tawny would be getting coffee from a cafeteria and going to their rooms. And it wasn't even about, I didn't really realize that through osmosis, I was learning all of the techniques and the thought patterns and practices that make them such legendary stylists. But just forcing myself to be in the same space as them, like really elbowing my way in when I could, gave me more and more opportunities to see how they worked. And what was so cool about Grace is she was so good at what she did and so aware of her practice, and it was so second nature to her that I got to see what the perfect process of styling was, basically. Like, she had it down to a science. It was like her living and breathing. It was just like I could see the boards becoming the racks of clothing, and the racks of clothing becoming the styled out looks, and the looks becoming hair and makeup concepts, and the full picture of creating an image. She was so brilliant at that. And very few people are, you know. She wasn't just a stylist. Like, she was the definition of a fashion editor, and there is a, you know, I do distinguish between the two, because I think styling is almost the practice of working with clothing tactically and putting looks together. But editing, in terms of being a visual fashion editor, is finding, you know, listening to the information that the collections and the clothes are telling you, finding and metabolizing that into a language that's transferable to an audience. And mm-hmm. and the two are kind of separate practices, but she was the best of both.
Let's talk about another full circle moment. You recently became the first Black woman to style the cover of Vogue. You styled Paloma. You even styled our new vice president, Madam Vice President Kamala Harris. What does that mean to you to, in 2020, 2021, to become the first Black woman to style the cover of Vogue and the cover stars that you were styling?
It was so weird because I didn't realize that I was. Like, it was something that I felt super prepared for and super excited about, but was also still like a very crazy concept to me, because in the grand scheme of my career, I could think back to 9 years ago and I was just starting out. Like, a decade is not a huge amount of time to kind of fulfill your dreams. And it was a dream of mine. Like, I wanted to be a Vogue stylist. I dreamt of styling the covers of the magazine. For as long as I can remember, I wanted to be the editor-in-chief of Vogue. Like, that is my dream job.
Wow, imagine Vogue under GKJ.
I mean,
iconic.
Maybe one day in the future, but it was very much like a bizarre situation where I felt like I totally had all the tools to pull it off, but I didn't really realize the magnitude of the moment until after it had happened. It was like I could finally breathe, and I knew the pictures were great, and I was excited for the world to see it. And then I was like, well, wait a minute, has anyone ever done this before? Like, has there ever been a Black woman who styled this before? And to do it with Paloma, who I think is the embodiment of what I like to, the beauty that I like to capture and express and share with the world in my work anyways, it was like this perfect cosmic alignment. And she and I also were friends in the beginning of our careers when, you know, she had just been discovered by Pat McGrath and she was just starting on her modeling track, and I was like an assistant. I think we met at a Hillary Clinton fundraiser fashion show. Like, it was not a real fashion show, but I was like a styling assistant, and she was like her first time walking down a runway, and to have that moment together was really insane. And I'm so proud of her, and I'm so proud that when we think of what a Vogue cover star looks like, that visual vocabulary has been expanded to include gorgeous women of color who aren't a sample size. Like, that's huge to me. And the vice president, it was, you know, an emotional experience with a lot of opinions on either side, but I just maintain that I'm so proud to have been able to work with another first and to have been trusted with kind of shepherding that experience. Even though I didn't style her for the cover, I felt like I was very much a part of engineering that moment. And I feel, I mean, that's completely surreal to think about, because.
What role did you play in that?
So I was a sittings editor for that shoot, which is essentially like a spokesperson for the magazine, somebody who makes sure that we get the picture and who, you know, is there to make the talent feel comfortable and to like liaise between all of the members of the creative team. It was photographed by Tyler Mitchell and Julia Wagner, who's a really brilliant set designer, did the set for it. And there was a little bit of discussion between us about what we wanted to capture, but ultimately, because there was no fashion involved in the way that it normally would be involved on a fashion cover, my job was kind of just to be there.
You were there at such a historic moment, and there were so many opinions that quickly emerged. There's no short of opinions in this world, especially on social media. As someone who has worked as hard as you have, even Tyler shooting it, it's like one of those things where the story kind of gets out of control, and the people who were actually a part of it don't really get to say anything about it. What does that surrealism actually feel like, especially in that moment?
It was really, really nuts because I have to say, I just wasn't anticipating a negative response. And then when I started to read the reactions, especially from, you know, the BIPOC community, I completely understood kind of the legacy of pain in terms of the portrayal of Black women on fashion magazine covers. And I understood the sensitivity of kind of the semiotics of a cover. Like, what does it mean to have that she's in a sneaker instead of a stiletto? Why isn't she in a gown? And why? And of course, there are things that we understand as professionals in the industry that is not common knowledge for the rest of the world. But the intricacy of the politics around what women wear when they are also supposed to be considered powerful, it's astounding. It's like it was a puzzle that I don't think anybody has unlocked, and we probably should never unlock because there should not be so much consideration about what a leader of the free world is wearing. But that's the struggle that we have as women in a misogynistic patriarchy, is like standards of beauty and respectability politics and the idea of sex appeal as a negative or interest in fashion as something frivolous. These are all things that when you're operating at the height of a vice president, surely you have to take them in, you know, take them into consideration. So I think that played a huge role in the fact that she wasn't styled and that, you know, I didn't pick the clothes because she had to be comfortable in what she decided to wear. And that was like, I was very happy to take a backseat to that because I don't think anyone should be telling Vice President Harris what to do in any part of her life. She's got it. She's got it on lock.
I really do feel like we should just stop focusing and telling people how to dress.
I do too. And it's just, and it go, what's so interesting, what was so interesting for me is I felt this responsibility to a community of Black women not to let them down with that cover. And
Of
that's what
course.
hurt me so much because a lot of the response was disappointment and that they were let down. And while I know there are ways of explaining why that decision was made, the reality and the only thing I actually care about is for that community of which I am a part to understand that there's nobody that I respect more than the Black woman, and there's nothing that I want to do more brilliantly than style the first Black female vice president of the United States of America. But it was just one of those, it was just like a live and you learn moment,
Of
100%.
course, things happen and then we move on. I mean, you continue styling covers and making history.
And I can't wait to do that forever and ever and ever. And I think that, you know, as I said, I still am very, very proud of that and of that cover specifically. And I just can't wait to see, you know, what she does that's like has nothing to do with what she's wearing.
Oh, totally, of course. Hi there. If you find our work beneficial and you want to support how we build our company at your service, you can subscribe to my Patreon at patreon.com/nor. It's usually personal writings, and as I build a community on there, hopefully more. Your support is how we build. I also curate a weekly newsletter of all the things I'm benefiting from and enjoying that week. anything from what I'm reading, watching, listening, buying, and more. Like most things, I keep it personal. You can subscribe to it at noortaghori.com/newsletter. Now back to the story. So you mentioned your value system and the value system that you held prior and it being revolved around exclusivity. Can you talk to me a little bit about what you enjoyed previously about exclusivity, what kind of exclusivity you enjoy now that you think needs to stay, and what your value system looks like today?
I think when I was much younger, I grew up predominantly in white middle-class neighborhoods. And I think my primary defense mechanism was like blending in. Like I just really wanted to make myself as small as I could and stand out as little as I could. And it's so in opposition to my personality, which is rather bombastic and like very loud, that I just thought that being like everyone else was a positive. And then I discovered fashion, and within the world of fashion and kind of like at an industrial level, there is like the commercial, which is supposed to be for everyone, for the masses, which has historically been thought of, you know, as undesirable. And then there is like the exclusive and the high. And I thought, and I think when I wanted to shed that desire to be like everyone else, the way that I did that in my mind was like, okay, well then I'm going to go so far to the other end of the spectrum where it's like, I am the pinnacle and the peak and the height of acceptability, of like, by abandoning this idea of being like the everyday girl, the everyday California girl that I never would be, I could feel confident in being different if I was like holding myself on a pedestal. Like if I was trying to be engaging with a system that I didn't think that they could understand or that they didn't get, or you know, that revolved around taste and something that wasn't about what I looked like or how much money my family had or which neighborhood I lived in. It was like an abstraction of that value system in a way. And when I think about that, it's embarrassing because it's 100% governed by insecurity and that like teenage kind of ennui and the idea of like, nobody gets me and nobody understands me. And like, I spent my life conforming and now I'm going to be the greatest and the best and the rarest and the, you know, the most exclusive. And that's what fashion was to me. It was like this very glamorous European, nothing that had to do with America or middle America or suburbia. And that was it for me. It was like, that's the kind of tier that I want to be in. And then when I got to New York and I started working in the industry, I realized that I couldn't, that they didn't want me there, you know, like that rarefied space, that value system that was kind of like this top down, you know.
Did you expect that at all?
I didn't. And I think that that was, okay, so I didn't and I did, to dual answer. I didn't expect that I would be, that it would be so overt a lot of the times in the ways that I wasn't accepted or I wasn't understood or like I wasn't wanted in spaces. But I also knew, just because I read magazines and I looked at fashion images and I watched The Hills, that there weren't people who looked like me in the industry. So I expected it to be like a shakeup, but I also thought it would be very similar to experiences that I had in, you know, boarding school or in, you know, I guess the schooling system is all you basically have before you start working. So let's say school, which is that I was like different, but that was desirable because it was like exotic and it was easy to tokenize and I could be like the best friend and all the parents loved me and thought I was so interesting and cool because I, you know, was West African. And I thought like, okay, I can be a token and like, that's okay with me because it's just going to open the door and then I can start like shaking things up. But there wasn't even interest in tokenizing me. And that was what was so weird. You know, it was like, wow. No, we just don't want you here.
How was that said to you?
Yeah, I mean, I remember I worked at a e-commerce company called Moda Operandi, and I love the owner of that company. Her name was Lauren Santa Domingo, and I was obsessed with her, and I wanted to work for her because in my mind, she totally represented everything that we're talking about, like the height of fashion in society, and went to all the fabulous parties and wore all the major clothes and knew everyone. And I was just like, this is very, you know, this is almost like when I saw those pictures of my aunt on the runways in Paris. It was like, it just felt so glamorous and so unlike what it was for me growing up that I really wanted to kind of be in those worlds. So I ended up getting an internship and I worked really hard for the fashion director at the time, who's Taylor Tomasi Hill. And then I heard that Lauren was looking for an assistant and I really wanted to go up for the role. And somebody within the HR structure was like, I just don't think that's like the right role for you, but like, you should kind of like look towards like the buying and back end side of things. And I really want to put you in the warehouse because I think that you're just so smart and you can understand the Excel sheets. And I was like, okay, sure, let me try it out. And I did it for a couple of weeks and I was like, this isn't what I want to do. And I was, you know, trying to bend towards it because I wanted to be here. But ultimately I want this job with Lauren. And I ended up talking to my superior at the time. And she was like, you know, Lauren just really needs like a Vogue girl. She needs a Vogue girl. You know, she needs like one of those like, you know, cute, blonde, connected, rich girls. It's just like what she needs. And I was like, oh, okay. And it was the first time that I was like, it doesn't matter that you worked your heart, you worked your hardest. It doesn't matter that you're a part of the company culture. It doesn't matter that you're capable of the job. Things so beyond your control that just have to do with the essence of your identity are going to keep you from getting this job. And funnily enough, I kind of accepted that. And it was a really dark moment. And I was like, well, maybe I'll just never be that person, which means I'll never be able to kind of break into the ranks of fashion. But I happened upon an interview in Hamish Bowles' office at American Vogue because a colleague of, or, you know, another student at Barnard who had been Hamish's assistant was leaving the role. And she wrote me and was like, hey, I know that you're interested in fashion. I think you should go in an interview for this. And I ended up getting a job at American Vogue. So all of this time when my superior was-
You were the Vogue girl.
She needed a Vogue girl. And then I ended up becoming a Vogue girl. So yeah, but that is, that's one instance. You know, there were actually
countless. That's so
major
though.
It was major because I was like, you know what? There are going to be roadblocks for sure. And there are going to be things that I actually can't control that will prevent me from easily achieving my goals, but it's never going to be impossible. Hard, but not impossible. Yeah. So, but yeah, there were moments of really blatant expressions of the fact that like, I don't belong. And it's just like the way it is. And everybody knows that there's a problem with it, but it's just like the way it is. And you kind of just have to get used to it. So.
Well, now the way it is changing a little bit. There have been several national and international tragedies that have raised conversations around the white supremacy that is rooted in our country. And corporations, media networks, brands making promises they've never made and we never thought they would make around making diversity and inclusion an actual priority. Oftentimes that can be performative and you and I have both had similar feelings of struggle around knowing that we have worked harder than anyone around us, but even when we get the opportunities, there are people who will say things like, well, you only got this because that's what people need right now. Similarly to you wanting to apply for that assistant position and them saying, we're looking for this girl. We know that people are also doing that, but how do we begin this conversation and how do we reckon with this and make sure that it doesn't tamper with our own self-worth?
Right. Oh my God, Noor, if you know, tell me because I have no idea how we have the conversation. It all kind of stems from the fact that I'm very aware, at least for me, I'm very aware of the ways in which I've internalized white supremacy. And I think a manifestation of that has been the willingness to be tokenized, if that means that the door, I've shoved the door open and now I'm in the room and now I can build the table that has seats for everyone else, you know?
Of course.
Yep. And part of me wishes that there was just, that I could express this intense radical energy of being like, well then forget the fashion industry. I'm going to build the alternative. Like I'm going to find a way to satisfy my love for this industry, the importance of this industry in terms of communicating outwardly ideals of beauty, of creativity, of cultural legacy, of history, visual history. I'm just going to create another kind of way of expressing that because this industry is built on white supremacy and I'm not willing to engage with it in one way or the other. But I haven't done that and I can't do that. And I'm not sure how fruitful it is. Although I know that revolutionary action, radical agency is, it's the dream that I would be able to achieve that. But right now I recognize that it kind of takes two to tango and it feels icky sometimes. And it feels insurmountable or like, unnavigable in a lot of ways. And part of that is definitely what you speak about, which is this idea that like, okay, we are finally reckoning with white supremacy as a structural system in the history of mankind. And it's trickled down to every single industry. And maybe there are more opportunities for me right now because these brands need to start, you know, hearing from different voices and telling different stories and making Black creatives central to their business models by virtue of the fact that that's what their customer base and what the world is demanding. But it's also like, isn't it better for me to engage with that authentically and at the risk of being tokenized than to allow the system to persist as it does?
The way that I think about it, and I've thought about this so much because I have to come to peace with that, but I realize that the problem is never us. The problem has always been the system. So it's not that we're not qualified or we're not good enough or whatever it is, but if there haven't been enough spaces or even a space in the system or in the industry that we're working in, and now they're finally realizing what we have always known.
Mm.
And now people are getting hired more and more and it's becoming a priority. To me, it's almost like, great, keep the gates open. Let's play catch up because we have centuries of catch up to play. It's the only way that I feel like fully comfortable about it. I keep thinking about the example that you just mentioned with the assistant and wanting this blonde, well-connected Vogue girl. All of that screams comfort to me. Just staying complicit, staying comfortable, not taking risks, not diversifying our way of thought, the teams that we build. Oftentimes, these teams keep yes people around them and don't want people who are going to challenge their habits or their norms or whatever it is, because a lot of people are afraid to change and afraid of change. And we have this really unique perspective that I think, because I also grew up in a very conservative white rural town.
Mm.
And we've seen like both worlds. Like we know the world within our households and our families and our friends. And we know the world of like these smaller towns. And we have had to shapeshift ourselves to get to this pure, authentic version of us. We had to go through multiple identities, but so many people in the dominant culture have not had to go through multiple identities to figure out who they are. So they remain afraid and comfortable because they were never forced to challenge themselves and their identities the way that we were. We had no other choice. In order to survive, we had to figure out who we were. But what incentive do other people have? And that's like the thing that I'm holding on to. That makes me realize that if you don't embrace challenging your way of thought, diversifying your friends, your family, your workplace, whatever it is, then I'm always going to think so much bigger than you because I have so many other people and ways of thinking to pull from. I'm going to have so much more creativity and ideas because I didn't stay in this comfortable, tiny, close-knit group that just says yes to me and doesn't care to take it any further.
Right. And that's what gets me a little bit scared, to be honest, is when I hear like a, well, yeah, but you got the job because, they needed a black girl and there's not really many black girl stylists working at your level. So like you always have to kind of keep that in mind. When I hear that from colleagues, like sometimes even friends, because like, hello, there are people who have to do the work within our closest communities. Like there are people that I love very dearly who are still figuring out how to have the conversations, what vocabulary to use when we're discussing issues of like dismantling white supremacy. But what scares me when I hear those kinds of justifications and this like, affirmative action kind of language is that they're still subscribing to that value system of like normalcy and comfort and complacency is supreme. And like this is a moment in which we kind of like need to gratify and like satisfy this the dominant opinion that things should change, but there's no real investment in investigating the ways in which this structural, white supremacy as an organizing principle has permeated every single element of our lives. And like that's what's really scary to me is that there are people who understand what's happening in this moment, and the need for it, but can't help themselves from still subscribing to all of the ideas we're trying to dismantle collectively. And so the only answer to me is like, keep being there, keep being in the room, keep
Keep
having a
showing
seat at the
up.
table, keep showing up. And it's showing up in uncomfortable environments. It's showing up in institutions that I think have legacies of racist behaviors or legacies of perpetuating white supremacist ideas. But I would rather be there than not be there. I would rather be there to try and change the systems in place than to watch them kind of like perpetuate.
Sometimes people just want to be there because they like their job and they want to be there to make a living and they want nothing to do with changing a system. And because so many of our sub-communities are so traumatized, it isn't members of that community's responsibility to reform the system or dismantle the system if they don't have the desire or mental capacity to do so. I never started in journalism thinking I was going to change the journalism industry. And you didn't start in fashion thinking you were going to change the fashion industry.
No.
But the only way you're able to 100% show up as yourself is by making that change and being vocal about that change. How much of that is our responsibility and how much of that is the responsibility of the executives and the people who have already benefited and built this racist system.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the question. And I think this is like, can I curse?
Yeah, you can say this is your storytelling.
Okay, because there is this, I have this motto, which is that for most women of color and most minority women, our motto is literally, fuck it, I'll just do it myself. Like that is like how we
100%.
survive. Like that is how we move through the world. Like that is our mantra, because there's a real reluctance to creating systems in which we can thrive. Like we will always be the oppressed. And I do think that we just can't trust the system and the powers that be, the gatekeepers and majority stakeholders in these problematic institutions to be doing the work to create space for us. So we create it for ourselves. And it feels like a responsibility, to your point, it feels like a responsibility that should not be ours. Like it's not my job to change the fashion industry so that people like myself can be there. It's the job of the gatekeepers to be doing their own work to understand their, how the ways in which they're complicit in exclusive systems, and then rewire it and rewrite the codes of like what is fashion and who should be at the table. But I just don't really have any faith in the system to do that, so I'm gonna do it.
Right. I mean, you're doing a great job. It's like a bittersweet thing because oftentimes that requires us to continue working in a place that we know has a type of feeling towards us. But now, if you have experienced passive aggressive comments or microaggressions or whatever it is today, how do you handle that? And how would you advise people in their workspaces who struggle with speaking up to handle that?
It took me a very long time to overcome the, I guess we have all started talking about it as imposter syndrome. And what I realize is that is like totally the ways in which we've internalized misogyny and the ways in which we've internalized racism and other people's justifications of excluding us. And as soon as I kind of unlocked that I should be there, that even when I go to the most base logical kind of evaluation of what I've done in my career, the steps I've taken, the work I've put out, even when I have to strip it down to like the laws of empirical science, it's like you've shown yourself that you believe that you belong here. You've done the work. You've like have it out in the world. You've gotten the response. What else, what more do you need to know that you belong? So when I kind of experience those microaggressions now, I'm empowered, you know, I have a stronger arsenal to combat it because I feel so strongly about the work that I create and in my, I believe in my success and I believe in what I'm trying to do. And honestly, the most effective and also most like spiritually and like psychically fulfilling way to kind of confront those microaggressions or those like uncomfortable moments for me have been to confront them. Like, don't let them simmer. Don't reason it away, and don't give yourself the excuse of like, well, this is always going to be there. They're always going to think this way. Let me just like batten down the hatches and keep my head down and do what I got to do. It's like, no, nobody's here to make it comfortable for somebody who's going to be racist towards you or misogynistic towards you or not believe in you. If they don't feel like they can say outrightly and candidly all of the, you know, vitriolic things that are underlying microaggressions, then you need to make sure that they know that you know what they're actually saying and make it uncomfortable. Like it's not supposed to be, you don't have to be like having the, you know, most surface level kind of like get through the day conversations with your colleagues and your coworkers. These are people who are in your intimate community that you work with and see every day on Zoom, who you have an intimate relationship with, whether you want to or not. And they need to, you need to have the most clarity in your communication with them as you would with a friend or a family member.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the storytelling session. I just wanted to share something with you. If you're looking for a good deed opportunity these days, my family has been working to alleviate local homelessness for over 10 years. We have a foundation called I See You. And we make care packages for people experiencing homelessness. We make family food bags with food staples and give out grocery gift cards to families in need and more. Everything is done by donation and 100% of the money goes towards community members in need. If you'd like to donate, you can through Venmo at ISY Foundation or PayPal to contact@isyfoundation.org. If you or someone you know is in need in the DC, Maryland, and Virginia area and could use our help, please DM on Instagram ISY Foundation or shoot us an email. Now back to our story. This morning, someone texted me asking for a favor, and it was like a favor that I didn't know if I could actually do it. And I said to Adam, why is it so hard for me to say, hey, I actually haven't been in touch with them as much, especially in the last year. I would love to support in any way I can. Do you have any ideas of how you'd want me to, whatever? And then Adam was like, then just say that. And then he said, the reason it's so hard for you to say that is because you're so worried about other people taking it personally. But one, that's not your business. And two, if you have the intentions of sharing something honestly with other people, if they make it about them and not what you said and the situation, then that's on them. But that's not emotional labor that you have to manage.
Right, definitely. And I think that like, is so ingrained in so many women of color specifically, but I think it's like this idea of like protecting and nurturing and like taking care of everyone else's feelings and like making sure that you are of service. You're of service. Like whatever you're doing, it's in service of something is like something that's really, really hard to shake. And I was for so long so sensitive. It was like, as I said, it was all about making myself like smaller and not as noticeable.
Totally.
Or on the very other end of it, being like a caricature and like the girl who's like always here for you and the big hugs and the and it was all in service of like making other people feel comfortable with my presence because I felt the projection of their discomfort. And it's like, I'm just done
Oh
with
my
that
gosh,
now.
yes. Yeah,
I'm just
but
done with
also you
that.
can't actually be of service to other people until you're of service to yourself. And we often miss that part of the equation, which is, are you checking in with you? Do you have the bandwidth to do this? Do you have the space? Do you want to respond to this? I remember even at my last corporate job that I did, so much of my day ended up being consumed with giving relationship advice to everybody around because there were relationships that were happening with our team members and the work that we needed to get done wasn't getting done efficiently. So I was just like spending 3, 4 hours helping people who were making the same mistakes over and over and over again. And I realized I wasn't adding any value. I was just there as a crutch. Oh, I hate that feeling. It's so
I hate
gross.
that feeling too. It is so gross, but I have experienced it 1,000 times and just know that I share that
Thank you.
frustration with you. But yeah, no, I just feel like I was very, very nervous for a very long time, especially in the workplace and especially in the fashion scape, which has always been like kind of notoriously considered like a bitchy, like behind the back kind of industry. It just doesn't have to be that way. Like, I have real issues with the way that the industry is set up, the players in the game, who gets the seat at the table, and what images we put out into the world and what stories we tell. I have real issues with that. And what is the point of working within that system if I'm not constantly going to remind everyone what issues they are and like how they're
Yeah.
playing roles in
Can you
it?
name some of
And
those issues for us so we can be mindful of them too?
yeah, I mean, I think, for example, when I talk about who is sitting at the table and who can, who is allowed to occupy that space, very literally, like allowed, like able to, like has the means to kind of work within the fashion industry. I think about the fact that my starting salary at Condé Nast was like $28,000 and it was not enough money to live off of. And the reason why that was not a bigger issue is because
In New York City, just to clarify.
In New York City, and that's kind of where the fashion industry is, centered, like in LA or in London, in Paris, in Tokyo, any of these places would be an issue because the cost of living is insane. But it wasn't an issue within the framework of that part of the industry that I was working in because people didn't have to work for a living. So it inherently became, it homogenized the environment because if you didn't grow up with money and if you didn't have money to live off of, you couldn't have this job because you wouldn't be making a living. And then when I talk about the images that we put out into the world, I totally recognize and also I'm very proud to be a part of a kind of new guard of creatives who aren't thinking about plus size bodies as anything other than
A
beautiful
body.
models, a body. But the idea of kind of like segregating diversity as, different boxes to check, or even when it is supposed to be presented holistically and in celebration of that, making the image about diversity. Like we just really need to be normalizing the fact that different types of beauty are still beauty, full stop, period. And those are the kinds of images that we should be focusing on making. Those are the kinds of stories we should be focusing on telling, rather than kind of keeping that status quo baseline of what has historically been like the Eurocentric fashion image with a caveat of like diverse fashion styling and image making. We need to be expanding what we put out in the world in terms of our visual output. And then, besides the seat at the t the seats at the table, just the table itself. It's like we also need to be uplifting and centering different ways of putting artwork out there. I think we need to really dismantle the idea of like the elite luxury publication versus the, young creator on Instagram. Like we need to collapse the world of content so that we can, and the world of art, really, so to speak, so that we can actually see the best of it
Is
rather
it
than
about making
being.
that accessible?
Maybe it's about making it accessible. I think this goes to a point that you spoke about earlier. It's like, I still deeply value luxury, and it's because I value the artisans and the work and the depth of concept and of creation in this level of fashion making. But I don't think that it should be exclusive in that we should all be able to appreciate it. We should all be able to engage with it, even if we can't all afford it. It shouldn't be about not having access to it, because A, I still fully believe in aspiration, and B, I also think that a young student at Central St. Martin's is creating luxury that actually is accessible and that actually is affordable. It's just a different definition of luxury, so to speak. So really like changing the container or like the platform for ideas, I think.
I would totally come to a lecture of yours on fashion. Your perspective and the way that you talk about fashion and the industry is so unique in that you're presenting tangible new ideas and concepts that we really need to reflect on more. And you have really good stories and metaphors. And I just want to thank you because you're just a great storyteller and I really appreciate it.
Thank you. That is a huge compliment because I really like to think I'm a good storyteller and it's not always the case. So to be affirmed by Noor, okay, come on. I mean, she is the storyteller extraordinaire.
Oh my gosh. So, I could talk to you forever. There's something that I really want to get deeper into. Mm-hmm. We have talked about the beauty standards that most people still hold. I mean, I struggled with not being blonde and blue-eyed my entire life up until I was 14 years old. And even when I went to Libya, which is the country that my parents are from, and I met my cousins and my family members there, I remember seeing one of our cousins wearing blue-colored contacts to her wedding. And in fact, Libya is actually where I got my hair highlighted blonde and I got colored contacts to come back to America. And I have cousins who are blonde hair and blue-eyed because some Libyans are, and they have siblings who have darker features. And even if I thought the sibling with darker features is always more beautiful, the narrative around it would always focus on the person who fit more Eurocentric standards. And that's not to say that they weren't beautiful too, but I was always so confused about that. And I struggled with it myself. And that was because of representation on television and in magazines, because this was a space that I wanted to be in. And I was just like, well, there must be a reason that people who look like me are not in this space. And it must be because they can't be. And so I have to look this way. Mm-hmm, with your evolution of the beauty standards you hold close to you, what did that look like when you were younger, and where did that stem from, and how has it evolved?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm really happy you asked me about this, because I think about that. It's difficult to talk about, but I think about it all the time, because I think it is so, like, it's the basest of baselines that have kind of, you know, colored the evolution and my journey towards self-love. But A, as I said, we really always grew up in predominantly white communities. And even if it wasn't just like the popular girl in school or the prettiest girl on swim team or, you know, the girl next door kind of all-American vibe that we all internalize from movies and TVs and, as you said, lack of representation, I also just grew up with a brilliant, strong, amazing single Black mother, because my father died when I was very, very young, and she had never she could never imagine a world in which we weren't the most beautiful things on the planet. And so we never had the discussion about the ways in which, like, how she valued what we looked like and how we felt and, like, who we are as people would not be reflected outwardly, in the world. We didn't really talk about it. And also, I think I always associated beauty with desirability. And, like, it always was, like, who are the boys crushing on? And who is the hot girl in the TV show?
Same,
and,
100%.
And 1,000%. It was just, like, desirability and beauty weren't two different things to me. They came hand in hand. And something that I've really started thinking about was the fact that I...
Whoa. That was just a big unlock for me.
Yeah, it's a huge unlock. It's, like, I was raised by a single mom, and I never had a male presence within my household affirming my beauty just as my father or as my brother or just, you know, I didn't have the male-female relationship of it all. I just completely assumed that whatever the world was telling me was what was true about myself, because I didn't, you know, I couldn't find the kind of like familial take on it all.
The patriarchy works only if women want to be desired by a standard male gaze. And so we are trained from a very young age to assume that if that person thinks I'm hot, then I'm hot, not if I think it, or my mom thinks 100%. It, or my friend thinks it, or whatever it is. It never started with us. It never started inside of us. It always started with a male gaze.
100%. A male gaze. And that's what I like had a hard time. I hope it didn't sound creepy the way I was explaining it. I just mean there was no male presence in my house. So I never, and that was the way you affirmed it. That's the way I thought you affirmed, you know, beauty. And so, yeah, for a long time I was like, well, I'm gross and this sucks and I look nothing like what is considered beautiful and I never will. And it like, actually, it sounds very vapid, but that feeling of not being pretty, like, also affected like not being my sense of self-worth, like not being pretty also meant I wasn't worthy, and like not being worthy meant that, you know, there was something wrong with me, and like so many of the emotional struggles I've had I think literally stem from Eurocentric white supremacist ideals of beauty. It's like, it's really, you know, it's profound in a way, because it's like we're kind of raised with this like second wave feminist idea of like, it doesn't matter, like prettiness doesn't matter. Don't care about what you look like. And it's all about what is on the inside. But the reality is like this world is structured around what we are on the outside in more ways than one, whether it's like race or beauty or
yeah, we
money
can't ignore
or
it.
We can't ignore it. And it's not to say that it needs to be everything, but I think in a lot of ways it affects the molecular, at a molecular level, how we feel about ourselves.
Yeah, there's a book by Sonia Renee Taylor. She writes, The Body is Not an Apology, and talks about how radical self-love is really the solution to so many of the systemic problems, and the lack of self-love and self-worth, even with the people who wrote the Constitution, is why so many oppressive systems existed. Because if they had radical self-love for themselves, they wouldn't have felt the need to create a hierarchy that is unattainable for so many of us. And just even realizing that has been a really big unlock for me. I would love to know what your relationship with beauty standards and body image is now, with you knowing all of this and having gone through this whole process.
Now I'm feeling myself. Now
I mean, you're just so like, fab.
I'm fab, and like I'm like here to be. I'm here to make myself happy and to love on myself and to appreciate myself. And I think that, as you said, that self-love, that like radical self-love, radiates outwardly. And I also recognize now that I was always beautiful. It wasn't just because I decided to be okay with ignoring society standards. It's that those standards are arbitrary. And like that system is arbitrary. And the idea of a beauty standard in general is so crazy and so made up. And the way that we attach ourselves to this, like it is some God-given law, is crazy.
It is. It's like, it doesn't even make sense. Why are you adhering to something that literally doesn't make you feel good?
No, exactly. It's like,
and also it's so temporary. This is going to be gone so soon.
So temporary. And yeah, I don't know why we adhere to it for as long as we have, but I'm trying every day to chip away at it a little bit more. And that is not to say that I don't have days where I don't feel great about myself. I think we all have that. But my philosophy now is literally how it's literally like, how dumb can one be? Think of to allow a standard created by whatever system of thought, whatever many centuries ago dictated beauty at the time. And so now I'm just like, you know, my whole, I guess, relationship to it is like, it's not a thing. It's just not a thing.
It's just not a thing.
It's just not a thing.
Okay. I have some not so rapid fire questions because they're
what does that mean? Love it.
Nor questions. So nothing I ask is ever rapid fire, but I like to make it quick. All right. Mm-hmm. Who is a fashion designer you're really excited about?
Oh my God. There are so many. I really do think that Kenneth Ize is like a very, very brilliant designer, but also is creating a space for the kind of tradition of West African dress and habiliment as like to kind of infiltrate Western fashion and also infiltrate the luxury tier. And I just love having a West African designer kind of at that level. So I'm excited about him.
As more designers who come from different cultures and the dominant culture start putting out designs into mainstream, will people of other cultures wearing those outfits be considered cultural appreciation or appropriators?
I think about this all of the time. I literally, and I don't know what the answer is.
Because you're buying from a designer who is benefiting. What are we just not benefiting going from to the support fashion. Them?
Is, I know.
So is it once it becomes more dominant, once it becomes more mainstream, does that mean that, I don't know, I don't have the answer to it.
I think my impulse is that the luxury tier of the fashion industry will always exist. It will always be there. It'll always cost more money than clothes that you get at a department store. And it will always be available to fewer people by virtue of that fact. That being said, it still remains the indicator of every other tier of the industry, from like very kind of modest price points to very, very high price points. And if those brands dictating kind of the fashion culture are all heritage, old French fashion brands designed by old French people, you know what I mean?
Right,
then,
yeah.
Then there will never be any room to expand what luxury and what fashion looks like and what it means. So it's kind of like what we were talking about in the very beginning of this conversation. I would rather Teve and Kenneth and Christopher John Rogers and any number of designers who are weaving their own cultural heritage into their fashion products, I would rather them exist in a way that they can engage with the mainstream than to be always kind of like countercultural or you know, insider fashion, because that means that at one point the playing field will level. Like, at some point we're bound to meet in the middle and there actually will be equitable representation for all types of cultures and all types of
right. I mean, isn't that the goal?
I think people who buy it will be cultural appreciators. I think where it becomes problematic is when the person designing does not actually engage with or come from or understand that community or that culture.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Who is your favorite designer of all time?
Oh my God, these are the hardest questions of all time. I actually think one of my favorite design, I think it's Mrs. Prada. I think it's Miuccia Prada. And I think it's because the woman that she designs for has never stayed the same, has constantly evolved, but there's always been this like very specific, not just specific, but this very like inherent identity, like essence to who that woman is. And it's like, there is a real cerebral power to the clothes that she creates and like a real power of thought. And so I really, really love that. My second would be Nicolas Ghesquiere because I became obsessed with fashion right at the time he was designing for Balenciaga. And oh my God, I just remember I would set my alarm to wake up in the middle of the night in my boarding school in Southern California to watch the Balenciaga runway show live on style.com. When style.com
wasn't Vogue.
Yeah, it wasn't Vogue Runway because Vogue Runway became, I think, style.com. Or style.com yeah, yeah. became Vogue.
I remember style.com. I would go on it every single day. And I remember when it became Vogue Runway and I was just like, what?
I know. It was like, and then style.com weirdly became a print magazine for a second. It was like very weird.
I didn't even know that. Wow.
Yeah, I have a few. They're like really large format. And literally the title of the magazine is style.com magazine.
But that's because the .com era was such a big, it was exclusive in itself.
Totally. Totally.
So it became that. Totally. What is your go-to look?
My go-to look is a old t-shirt. Usually it's like a graphic t-shirt because I have so many band and concert shirts, but then I also love going to Goodwill. So I'll get things with like, I don't know, like Ace's Hardware Store or whatever. And Levi's 501s that are like mid-rise and kind of bootleg and jacket. I'm obsessed with outerwear. Like usually it's like a leather trench or like a kind of cropped pattern jacket. And I always love a heel.
What are your thoughts on Gen Z completely abolishing the skinny jean?
Honestly, I take issue with abolishing the skinny jean because what is their answer to a thigh-high boot? Like you can only wear that with a skirt or a skinny jean. And I think you need to have that thinness of the ankle for certain footwear choices. Like we shouldn't, no, do we want to wear it with everything? Have we exhausted the silhouette to an extent? Yes, but we cannot, we must protect it at all costs because there are very specific skinny jean only moments that we need to preserve.
What are the top three items that you need on a set when you're styling that people wouldn't typically think of?
Top stick, which is usually for like men's like toupees. Like it's literally called top stick because it's like you put it on your head and then you put your toupee or like your wig on. And that's what it was invented for. But it's the strongest double-sided tape and it's really easy to peel off. So that for sure. Starch, liquid starch, which I don't think you, I understand why that would be something that you wouldn't think about a lot, but anytime you're working with like a cotton or an easily wrinkleable material, starching it and then doing like a very light iron or even a steam just like gives you a little bit more wear because you don't want to keep like taking off the thing and steaming it and putting it back on.
Wow.
And you always have to be aware of wrinkles. And then my other top three things. This is less mechanical, but it's really, really important. I always ask for a full length mirror because a lot of times I think, you know, as the creatives on the other side of the camera, we're like, we know best and trust me, you look amazing. And this is kind of what it's going to look like in the set and blah, blah, blah. But the
that first... always makes me uncomfortable. Because it never turns out the way I thought. I know,
the first consideration has to be, exactly. So the first consideration is like, look at yourself and what you look like. What would you want to do with your body? Or where would you, how would you, you know, be, inhabit this look so that you feel comfortable in it? And then we can go from there. And some people even like, when I have it, they'll even ask for me to like bring the mirror behind the camera and then they can see what they look like while they're like kind of posing. Cool. So that's
I mean, that's a brilliant idea. I love that.
Yeah.
Who is your dream cover star that you would like to style?
Stacey Abrams. I'm like obsessed with her. I literally think that she's my president. And I also think that she's so stunning and that she has never had, because of all the things we talked about when we were talking about the shoot that I did with Vice President Harris, it's like, she has never in any way kind of subscribed to the traditional political model. And I think that while she is always in like a suit and in a shell when she's like on the floor, I know that in there is like a brilliant fashion diva waiting to explode, and I just want to give her that fashion moment. I feel like it would be like an amazing meeting of the
I
minds.
would love to see that happen. I mean, it will happen. I know it will.
I mean, it's going to happen for sure, but it needs to, because I'm manifesting it as we speak, like writing in my journals, thinking about it constantly. But I do think it has to be the perfect venue where it's really just about like fun and creative expression and honoring and like adoring this like actual Renaissance woman. Like she is the pinnacle of the modern woman to me, and I just would love to work with her.
What is a staple item that everybody needs to have in their closet?
Honestly, this is like so boring, but I think everybody needs to have a crew neck white t-shirt. It just is like the perfect, sometimes I put it underneath like a denim jacket, sometimes it's underneath like a blazer. You can wear it with a suit to make it like cocktail instead of like, office wear, or like wear it with a tux and then you're like black tie, but like keep it cool. And it's so hard. I buy packs of the like 10 piece. I actually, oh my God, this is the best hack of all time. If you go to like a bodega, they sell Hanes crew neck white t-shirts, but they're like the irregular kind. Like they're the kind that were like rejected from the factory. And so they usually have like, they're not finished with whatever like starch or like whatever they finish the kind that's like really packed up in like Hanes stuff. So they're like way softer, but also raw, and they have like, better
How did you
shape to
find
them.
that out?
I found that out because I had to go to the gym one day and I thought I brought my gym bag and I hadn't brought my gym bag and I actually brought my work bag and I ended up having to go to a Duane Reade and I got a pack of the Hanes shirts and they looked like the normal pack, but then in like this very tiny writing in white at the bottom it said irregular and I was like,
That's
this is so
so
much better.
funny.
It's all
I
about an
mean,
irregular t-shirt.
what is your favorite boxing move since you have been working out at a boxing gym lately?
Oh my God, I'm literally obsessed with Gotham. It's like my new home. You know what? I think that I am a cross left uppercut right hook kind of girl. That's the combo that I like. I'll test it out for you one day.
I need to see that for sure. What is your go-to song that you listen to during your travels?
Ooh, during my travels. I listened to the entire Miseducation of Lauryn Hill album only because it's like one of like five albums on my downloaded to my Spotify. You know how you like can only use it if it's downloaded and it's like not. And so when I'm on a plane, I'm like, oh, I have five albums downloaded and it's always that. And
I
I
love
think
it.
Zion or The X Factor are my favorite songs on that album.
What is the first place you want to go to for a vacation after all of this?
I really, 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 really want to go to Italy. Like, I want to go. I've never been to Sicily, and I've actually never been to the south of Italy in
I studied in
general.
Sicily.
Oh my God, really? So you could give me all of the like recs.
It is maybe my favorite part of Italy. I studied sexual violence there
Oh my
for
goodness.
a couple of weeks.
Do you speak Italian?
I don't speak Italian, but my family is Libyan. So Libyan Arabic, because Italy was our colonizer, is Arabic mixed with Italian. So I can understand some things.
I wish that I could learn Chinese. I know that I can't.
Yeah, I said
Like, I
that 3 days
think
ago.
it's just not, I'm past the critical capacity to be able to like learn a different alphabet. I think I'm gonna have to stay within like
But you can always
romance
try.
languages. I can always try. I wonder what the best method would be because I just don't see it happening for me. And then I've also
I don't
always
know. I
wanted
mean,
to
they
learn
always
Russian.
say, obviously, speaking with other people, watching TV, and listening to music.
Or having a boyfriend. I also hear having a partner is
Ah, oh
helpful.
yeah. One of my best friends, she speaks maybe better Italian now than English because she married an Italian woman and
Voila.
she learned it out of needing to communicate. It was fantastic.
With her partner, exactly. You know what? This is what's gonna happen. I'm gonna go to Sicily. I'm gonna find a boo and I'm gonna learn the language and then I can tackle
100%.
Chinese. And then Russian
Oh
will be
my
my
gosh,
third.
yes. That's amazing. Okay.
Yeah.
A trend that needs to go away and a trend that needs to come back.
A trend that needs to go away. Oh my God.
It's really hard because, like, what are trends anymore?
What are, I don't even know what are the current trends.
Yeah,
oh,
I don't
you know
either.
What?
I've yeah.
always had like a real disdain for this and I don't even know why. But you know the Dansko clog? Like the, it's basically like the shoe that like nurses and chefs wear.
Yeah.
It's like 100%. A clog that's like all white or all black. That at one point it became like co-opted by like Brooklyn hipsters. And I always thought that it was like very, very annoying. Mostly because I'm like, just like let people who need those for their job wear them. Like don't try and make it a fashion statement. I want those, I want that to go away. And then a trend that needs to come back. Oh, without a doubt, the super, super flare denim, like JNCOs. Like, remember JNCOs?
I used to have those.
They're like, I want those to come back. They need to come back.
Wow. How fantastic. The only problem with those was that I would always get mud on them because they were never
like
tailored
when I was a kid. Yeah, they
would get ratty in the back. But they would get so gross. And finally, what do you know for sure?
Everything happens for a reason. I know that for sure. 1,000%. And that's probably, I hope that that doesn't sound trite, but it's something I didn't discover until very late in life. And my first, the first boss that I really connected with, Tawny Goodman, who is literally a saint and an angel and my wife and my sister and my best friend, she was her mantra. And it would be like me crying on the phone with FedEx because the Chanel got stuck in Milan and we can't get it here for our shoot. And she would just say, everything happens for a reason.
Totally.
And it was like really, really helpful.
A saving grace, especially in fashion where the littlest thing being missing can feel like a catastrophe.
That's really where I apply it the most. I mean, there are harder pills to swallow than others when you say everything happens for a reason. But in my day to day, when I feel, like I can't, like there are things that I can't get past or like there's something holding me back or that I just have, emotional response to something, just reminding myself that everything happens for a reason. Reminding myself that everything happens for a reason has always been, kind of safe harbor for me. So that I know for sure.
Well, thank you, Gabriella Karifa Johnson, the one and only.
Thank you.
I am
thank
so
you
excited
so much, Noor.
To watch your legacy flourish.
I mean, likewise, let's take over the world together. How does that sound?
100%. I mean, I already know that's happening. Like, I can see our, like, generation just coming up, and we're going to be like, yeah, I've known her for, like, 10 years. Like, that's what's going to happen.
Ugh, I can't wait. It's already happening.
I hope you loved this episode with Gabriella Karifa Johnson. You can follow her on Instagram at GabriellaK_J and continue following her journey. I know I am. If you'd like to watch the video version of this podcast, it is up on YouTube or Facebook, both/Noor. And to you, our listener, I want to thank you for your listen and support. I'd love to stay connected. Here are some ways I'm telling stories these days. You can text me if you are in the US or Canada. Yes, it is me, not a bot. I also text you intentional daily questions of the day. My number is 301-246-8894. You can follow us on social, on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and YouTube at Noor, and on Instagram at AYS. My Twitter, Snapchat, and Clubhouse is N Tagori.